te fam sa soti. Dim ki kote ou ale. Si si na l'enfer même chéri. La vie là c'est pour vous. Chaque matin réclamé. Je masse patate, je masse. Sous pas ton aller là. Depuis me rencontre au maman, tout n'est en bon flanel. Côté femme ça sorti. Dis-moi qui côté me parle.
Like many of you, like many Americans, I have felt frustrated and betrayed by the state of the mainstream media in this country, a media whose priorities seem out of step with their responsibilities. We need a media that strengthens democracy, not a media that strengthens the government. We need a media that enriches public discourse, not one that enriches corporations.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and this is WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
And welcome to Health Action on listener-supported community radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week, along with Catherine Davis and Bob Letter. Well, this week, it's our annual LGBT Pride Health Specialist, something we always do around LGBT Pride Day here in New York, and we're finishing up LGBT Pride Month, so it's now or never. In our first interview segment of the program, we're going to be taking the broader look at LGBT health issues across the United States. And then in our second interview, we'll be zeroing in a bit locally to take a look at what's going on for LGBT New Yorkers. So stay tuned for that. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. The congressional newspaper The Hill reports about a sweeping plan last week to reorganize how the federal government is structured. It was unveiled last week by the Trump White House and includes controversial proposals to impose work requirements on a variety of public assistance and health care programs. The plan touches on a wide range of government agencies, but one of its main proposals is to move the food stamp program out of the Department of Agriculture and into the Department of Health and Human Services, which would then be renamed the Department of Health and Public Welfare. A new Council on Public Assistance would then oversee programs for low-income people gathered all in one place, including food stamps and Medicaid. And it would have the power to impose uniform work requirements for those programs. The reorganization plan faces tough odds in Congress, however, where even aside from the dispute over work requirements, which Democrats oppose, any reorganization faces opposition from congressional committees that could lose power if their jurisdictions change. The new proposal would also merge the Departments of Education and Labor based on the idea that education and job training should go together. And it would also privatize the United States Postal Service and would merge the Department of Agriculture's food safety regulators with those in the Food and Drug Administration. The Office of Management and Budget said that while some of the proposals could be implemented by the administration without Congress, others would require congressional approval. The Associated Press reports that some viruses that cross over into the brain just might play a role in Alzheimer's disease, according to a new provocative study that promises to reignite some long-debated theories about what triggers the condition. The findings don't prove viruses cause Alzheimer's, nor do they suggest that the condition is contagious. However, a team led by researchers at New York's Mount Sinai Health System found that certain viruses, including two extremely common herpes viruses, do affect the behavior of genes that are involved in Alzheimer's. The idea that infections earlier in life might somehow set the stage for Alzheimer's decades later has simmered at the edge of mainstream medicine for years. However, it's been overshadowed by the prevailing theory that Alzheimer's stems from sticky plaques that clog the brain. This new study has even some specialists who never embraced the infection connection before, saying it's time for a closer look, especially as attempts to block so-called beta amyloid plaques have failed. The study also fits with mounting evidence that how aggressively the brain's immune system defends itself against viruses and other germs may be riskier than actual infections themselves. Alzheimer's specialists at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard University have performed experiments showing that sticky beta amyloid captures invading germs by engulfing them, and that's why the plaque starts forming in the first place. The team from Mount Sinai and Arizona State University came up with some viral suspects quite by accident. The study, funded by the National Institutes of Health, wasn't hunting viruses, but was looking for new targets for Alzheimer's treatment. The researchers were using complex genetic data from hundreds of brains at several brain banks to compare the differences between people who died with Alzheimer's and those who were cognitively normal. The team found viral genetic material at far higher level in Alzheimer's-affected brains than in normal ones. Most abundant were two herpes viruses known as HHV6A and HHV7 that affect most people during childhood, often with no symptoms, and then they lie dormant in the body. That wasn't unusual, however. Since 1980, other researchers have linked a variety of bacteria and viruses, including another type of herpes that causes cold sores, to increased risk of Alzheimer's. But it was never clear if the germs themselves were merely bystanders or actively spurring the condition. The new study went farther. Researchers used computer models to check how the viral genes interacted with human genes, proteins, and amyloid buildup. They found a lot of interactions, suggesting the viruses could even switch on and off Alzheimer's-related genes. To see if those interactions mattered, the researchers bred mice lacking one molecule that herpes seems to deplete. Sure enough, those mice developed more of those amyloid plaques. The research makes a viral connection much more plausible, but researchers cautioned that the study won't affect how patients are yet treated. Even if the findings pan out, they could change how scientists look for new ways to treat or prevent Alzheimer's. Already, the National Institutes of Health is funding a first-step study to see if an antiviral drug benefits people who have both mild Alzheimer's and different herpes viruses. However, the researchers caution that just having a herpes virus does not mean you're going to get Alzheimer's, as it may not have penetrated the brain. And lastly, Reporters reports that Dr. Atul Gawande, the renowned surgeon and medical writer who was just named to head a new healthcare company being formed by Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JPMorgan Chase to trim those firms' employee health care costs. Immediately afterwards, while speaking at the annual meeting of America's Health Insurance Plan, the Health Insurance Industry's Trade Association, Dr. Gawande cited surgery as the biggest U.S. healthcare cost and said there are ways to both cut costs and improve patient care when surgery is involved. Dr. Gawande said that some of the focus on high costs of healthcare in the United States, particularly prescription drugs, may be misplaced. With surgery the single biggest healthcare cost, he outlined ways he's worked with hospitals to standardize procedures, resulting in lower costs and better results for patients. Gawande also said that end-of-life care needs to be taken into account the wishes of patients, something he said which is sorely lacking now. Gawande also emphasized that health insurance should not return to an era of denying coverage for pre-existing medical conditions, saying that life itself is the accumulation of chronic illnesses and medical conditions. He also said that high-deductible health plans sold solely for catastrophic coverage just drive patients to ignore their ongoing health needs, resulting in higher overall costs. Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, and JPMorgan Chase announced their new joint healthcare venture in January, saying healthcare costs were rising so too fast and holding back each individual firm's economic growth. The companies said they would use big data analysis and other high-tech tools to improve care and cut waste. Their choice of Dr. Gawande to lead their new venture reflects plans to focus on the entire healthcare system and not just one particular factor or disease condition that may be driving cost increases. And that's the healthcare news for this week. The Health Action News, excuse me. We'll be back with our first segment in our annual LGBT Pride Health Special, taking a look at LGBT health issues nationally across the United States. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first interview segment of this week's annual LGBT Pride Health Special, we're going to be taking a look at a national level, what's been going on both in Washington, D.C., and sort of a national picture on the whole scene to kind of set the stage. And then in our second interview, we'll be going local to take a look here at what's going on in New York City. Joining us is Katie Keith, who's a coordinator and steering committee member for Out to Enroll. Welcome to Health Action, Katie.
Thank you so much for having me.
And before we get started, can you give us the elevator speech on who is Out to Enroll? What do you do?
Sure. So we are a national initiative, pretty much the only national initiative dedicated to really educating and empowering LGBTQ consumers when it comes to health insurance options.
Great. And what sort of programs do you operate?
So we work with state coalitions, national coalitions, to really make sure that we are doing inclusive outreach to LGBTQ communities who we know are way more likely to be uninsured than sort of the general or non-LGBT population. So it's, I think, really important to have LGBT people, LGBT groups kind of at that table and making sure we're reaching, you know, what is a very vulnerable community.
So maybe that's a good starting point. How are things looking in terms of enrolling LGBT folks in health insurance? We know before the Affordable Care Act kicked in, the numbers were, 25% or more were uninsured. How are things stand now?
It was very high. You're right. So we have fortunately made a ton of progress through the Affordable Care Act in the past, really 4 years since the law has sort of been fully in place. I can give you a few statistics.
Sure.
If you think about sort of low and middle income LGBT people, kind of folks under 400% of the poverty level, about $16,000 a year, back in 2013, before the ACA really kicked in, we had about one in three of those low and middle income LGBT people did not have health insurance. It was much, much higher than the general population for a variety of reasons we could go into of why folks are just more likely to be uninsured. If you fast forward, you know, even just 4 years to 2017 till last year, that number had dropped to about one in five.
So
we had 34% uninsured to about 22%. That was a 35% decrease in just those 4 years. That's the good news. We've seen a lot of progress. We've done a lot of really hard work there. Unfortunately, those numbers are still much higher than the general population. So I think, you know, we're very pleased with the progress, but there is still a lot more work to be done in ensuring that LGBT folks have the health insurance and healthcare access that they need.
So what do you think accounts for that disparity?
Yeah, so there's a number of, you know, sort of reasons that we still see LGBT folks uninsured. I think contrary to sort of conventional wisdom or, you know, what Will and Grace or Modern Family would have you believe, LGBT folks are disproportionately less, disproportionately more likely to be low income. You know, there is not sort of this pink or rainbow ATM in the sky that some folks think about. And so when you look at where people's income differential is, a lot of LGBT folks are living in places like the South, where overwhelmingly there has not been Medicaid expansion, for instance. And so, you know, I think that these numbers, that 22% uninsured rate that I'm really talking about, we're going to continue to work on that. I think it's going to be harder to get that much lower without seeing some big sort of coverage expansions in states where we know we have a lot of LGBT folks. I'm thinking of Georgia, Florida, Texas, where there's just a significant LGBT population and folks who are really kind of sitting in what we call that Medicaid coverage gap.
Okay, so let's then turn to the new political era in our nation, and particularly in Washington, D.C., where you are located. There was a big fight last year, and I'm sorry to say it seems to still be continuing and resurrecting this year, over the future of health care, particularly the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid, as part of our health system. What's at stake in all of that for LGBT folks across America, across the U.S.?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot at stake in terms of, if you just think about the pre-existing condition protections themselves, you know, there are many, many folks in the LGBT community for a variety of reasons living with pre-existing conditions. And that, when I say that, that could mean asthma, or it could mean HIV. For a lot of transgender people, sort of having a diagnosis of gender dysphoria for many years until, you know, all the way up until 2014 under the effect, that meant that you could simply be denied coverage and care altogether. You know, we still had trans consumers coming in, showing us their letters where an insurance company said, we refuse to cover you based solely on who you are, based on your gender identity. And so, you know, as we talk about kind of eroding some of these gains that we have made, there really is a lot at stake for the community from a variety of aspects of kind of who we are and what it means, as well as access to healthcare that many have been fighting for decades, to be quite honest. It can get into the politics of things, but I think at the end of the day, these are real people with real lives, and it's really important to keep that in mind, that there's a lot of harm that could be done here by many of the things that I think still, to your point, continue to be talked about on Capitol Hill.
What role have LGBT people and their organizations played in the sort of pushback against what the new Trump administration and Congress have been trying to do on the healthcare front?
Yeah, so there have been a lot of sort of coordinated efforts to do what we call kind of Affordable Care Act defense work, whether it's, you know, really pushing back against some of these changes in Congress last year with the big repeal and replace debate. LGBT groups were very much at that table and, you know, leading the charge. pushing out data of how many LGBT folks are in Medicaid coverage and, you know, making sure that that lens is there. Folks have also been, I think, really engaged alongside my organization out to roll in making sure that some of the sabotage from the last open enrollment period didn't sort of disproportionately impact LGBT folks. There was a ton of, you know, LGBT groups who really tried to push the word out, maybe some who we hadn't even seen engaged in the past. But after the Trump administration sort of cut that period in half and cut advertising budgets by 90% and, you know, cut out in-person outreach and enrollment, there's just a lot of sabotage going on. And so you saw a lot of LGBT groups kind of jump into the fray to make sure that they were at least doing what they could to ensure that folks were protected. I do think there's going to be sort of the next big wave, a new move by the Trump administration that's going to require a lot of effort and a lot of coordination, both from LGBT organizations themselves, but also LGBT individuals and allies, to kind of, again, make sure we're not losing some of the gains that we made through the law itself.
Now, one of the key sections of the Affordable Care Act that has particularly benefited LGBT people is what's called Section 1557 of the law that deals with civil rights protections. Explain for our listeners what that section does and then sort of how it's being threatened or even to some extent rolled back.
Mm-hmm. No, that's exactly right. And for folks who are not familiar, Section 1557, we are now calling it the Healthcare Civil Rights Law because that's exactly what it is. You know, and this is the provision that sort of makes the ACA a civil rights law. That part of the ACA says people should not face discrimination in healthcare based on factors like sex and age and race and disability. What the Obama administration did, that where we're now seeing the rollbacks, is they actually looked at the six non-discrimination protections and said, well, of course, sex includes gender identity and it includes sex stereotyping. And the way that they really interpreted that part of the law was to protect LGBTQ people. So whether you are in a same-sex relationship, whether you are non-binary or gender non-conforming, or whether you are transgender, the Obama administration put in this regulation that you should not face discrimination in healthcare. And in healthcare, that sort of means when you go to the hospital, when you go to a clinic, when you interact with your health insurance provider, in all of those instances, you should be treated equally, regardless of who you are, who you love. So that's sort of what 1557 does. It has really opened the door tremendously for access for LGBTQ folks kind of across the spectrum. We know that this is an area, data shows this is an area where especially the transgender community still faces a lot of discrimination and, you know, difficulty accessing affirming healthcare, even when it's medically necessary and you have someone saying you need it. There are a number of barriers that folks face. So it's kind of what that part of the law does. Almost right after this regulation was finalized by the Obama administration, we saw a number of religious providers, religious hospitals, religious doctors, and a number of Republican state attorneys general file a lawsuit against the regulation, sort of saying, you know, challenging the Obama administration's interpretation of what sex means. So back in December, New Year's Eve in 2016, there's a judge in Texas who kind of halted these protections, at least as they're enforced by the government. Instead of sort of fighting that decision in court, which I think is what an administration would normally do in this case, the Trump administration said, okay, judge, we understand. Let us take this regulation and revisit it. We'll go rewrite it. We'll go make sure that it follows your ruling, and we'll come back to you. And so that regulation has been sort of in limbo for, you know, over a year now. And right now we're sort of waiting for that new regulation based on what the Trump administration's interpretation will be to be released probably next month in July. So I know that was sort of a long...
No, that's fine. When it comes out, what happens? Does it automatically go into effect? Does the public or Congress play a role? What happens?
So this will only be... That's a terrific question. This will just be a proposed rule. And so this will be kind of our first look at how they want to change this regulation from what the Obama administration did, where I think it's going to be really critical for LGBTQ people and organizations and allies is that there's going to be a really robust public comment period. And I know that that's going to be something my organization is organizing, as well as many others, to say we need as many people to weigh in on this change as possible, to say either I disagree with this because everyone deserves access to healthcare, or to say here's how I have been discriminated against in the past and why these protections are important to me. So I think it's similar to some of the other, you know, rule changes we've seen under the Trump administration. But I think as a community, we're really going to have to mobilize and sort of push back against these changes. Even though we're going to be doing that, you know, there could be a lawsuit that challenges the regulation in the future. It doesn't really change the statute, which I think, or the law itself. So we would argue that trans people, LGBTQ people are still protected. I only say that because, you know, we're going to have to weigh in really hard and heavy on this. But kind of regardless of that outcome, we're going to keep fighting. And I think LGBT folks should still feel confident that they're, you know, protected from discrimination in healthcare.
And although this stuff sometimes can seem incredibly policy wonky, and it can certainly go that direction, for regular everyday people, sometimes just sharing your own story and telling your own story as part of the mix really helps and makes a difference.
That's exactly right. I couldn't have said that better.
So, well, thank you. So let's talk a little bit then about some of the issues around transgender exclusions. One company, this insurance company, that's sort of been in the spotlight recently is a relatively new insurance company on the scene called Oscar. What's going on there?
Thank you for asking about this. So Oscar is sort of a new, kind of a new startup health insurance company that saw an opportunity under the Affordable Care Act and decided to jump into the health insurance game. And so Oscar is based in New York, but sells kind of Affordable Care Act or marketplace policies in a number of states across the country. So not just New York, but across the gamut. We did an analysis and sort of uncovered that Oscar, at least in some of the states where it was selling coverage, continued to use something called a transgender exclusion. And so this is sort of language in the actual health insurance policy that is really nasty and dated language, but essentially says, we don't cover anything related to you being transgender. We don't cover you as a person based on who you are. And in the past, this has been rife with abuses. You've had, you know, trans people go in for a broken arm and have that service denied because it was, quote, related to hormone use, or things, really bad things that no one would agree are right. And so this language, even though it's sort of prohibited under the Affordable Care Act for multiple reasons, we continue to sort of find it in Oscar's policies. But they weren't doing it in every state. They were only doing it in some states. So states like Ohio and Tennessee had this really nasty language, but you didn't see it in California or in Texas, for instance. And then there was this part where, you know, Oscar was quoted on the record as sort of saying, we want to offer this coverage, but we can't. We're not allowed to. And so I think a number of us kind of helped wonks, if you will, advocates sort of saw that and said, you know, we can't let this stand. This is this doesn't comply with the law. We don't we're really worried about all these other rollbacks. We need to kind of call Oscar out. And so last week, my organization Out to Enroll and the National Center for Transgender Equality, along with 40 other sort of state and national groups, sent an open letter to Oscar, really challenging this decision, encouraging them to offer transgender inclusive coverage in every state. They shouldn't be sort of picking and choosing. If the care should be covered, we think it should be covered everywhere. and asking them to make that change. I think it's especially important because on the day that we released this letter, Oscar also announced that it was expanding to additional states to offer marketplace coverage. So there's this fear that, you know, they could continue to use these very discriminatory exclusions and then spread them even further. And we wanted to really kind of get attention to this issue and bring it, you know, put it on the record that this is not something they should be doing and that we're kind of keeping an eye on them, if you will. So that's what's going on there. I don't do exclusions in New York, and I haven't heard about them.
Yeah, no, we've got pretty good protections in place here in New York, and I think also in New Jersey where Oscar also offers products. I'm not sure if they offer products in Connecticut or not, but at any rate. And just to remind people, Oscar's one of its major investors is folks from the Kushner family, so just make note of that. So let's say now we've been talking a lot about sort of defensive stuff that's been underway. Let's sort of flip that around and think a little bit proactively. What do we as a nation need to be thinking about and doing? And what are advocates like yourself who engage with federal government entities on a regular basis? What's your proactive agenda?
You know, I think, unfortunately, we are in sort of a defensive posture.
Yes,
right now.
I know.
And even a little bit harder.
All of us are,
Right. And I think especially on these issues, I'm sort of heartened by the amount that we have been able to protect either from the courts or from, you know, people calling Congress and really making their voice heard. I do think where we need to go is, you know, making sure that kind of folks' out-of-pocket costs continue to go up. I think we've made a lot of progress under the ACA, whether that's, you know, looking at prescription drug coverage and bringing those costs down, whether it's looking at deductibles. I think, you know, it's one thing to have insurance, and it's really important that you're protected from kind of catastrophic costs. But at the end of the day, if you can't afford to go to the doctor, we know that we're missing folks when we shouldn't be. And
right.
So, you know, as we look at wages stagnating, as we look at all these other reasons, how can we sort of bring costs down for everyday people so that we're really encouraging good health care and not just coverage for the sake of coverage? So that I don't have the answers on that yet.
Yeah,
there's a lot to that, but that is something that I do worry about quite a bit.
Yeah, it's not just enough to be able to buy an insurance company, but you have to be a policy. But you have to be able to afford to use the policy. So there's two sides to that coin. Exactly. What about on issues of health equity? I don't know to what extent you focus on this in your own work, but for LGBT people and populations, what are some things that jump out in that regard?
Yeah, so I think that having and really focusing on LGBT inclusive efforts, you know, really helps achieve the goal of health equity. I think this is, you know, a community and a population where other healthcare movements should be considering, in part because you look at the disparities and there's some real data there. There's some really important work to be done to ensure that you're, you know, covering everyone and making sure that healthcare and health insurance works for everyone. You know, there is a significant overlap between LGBTQ folks and communities and immigrants and people with disabilities. And so all of that, I think, has to be reflected and included. I think it becomes really, you know, important when we talk about things like Medicaid expansion, particularly in the South. There's a lot of LGBT folks of color living in Georgia, Florida, Texas, as I've sort of said. And how do we make sure that those folks are getting the access that they need and that they, you know, frankly deserve, because we have that's how the law was sort of designed. So I think LGBT communities kind of add another dimension to equity work, if you will, if that makes sense. And I think it's that lens is more critical than ever as we're all continuing this fight.
Great. Well, just in our last minute, let me throw it sort of wide open to you. Any last thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners about issues around LGBT health and access and coverage and so forth across the United States?
No, I think stay tuned. We're going to really need everyone who is willing and able to lend their voice and lend their attention for this really big fight to roll back Section 1557, the healthcare civil rights law, as you mentioned. We're expecting it in July, and so I think stay tuned to hear from us about kind of how you can get involved and how you can push back. It's a rule that literally has saved lives, and it's going to be really bad if we lose it. So we're going to need everyone's help in that fight.
Great. So those are our marching orders, everybody. We've been speaking about LGBT health issues across the United States. Our guest has been Katie Keith, who's a steering committee member with Out to Enroll. Thanks so much for joining us on Health Action, Katie.
Thanks so much. Have a good one.
You're welcome. And we'll be back with our second segment in a moment, zeroing in on LGBT health issues here in New York. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our second interview segment for this week's annual LGBT Pride Health Special, we're going to be going local, taking a look at what's happening for LGBT people here in New York City. And joining us is Wendy Stark, who's the executive director of the Callan Lord Health Center. Welcome to Health Action, Wendy, or welcome back, I guess I should say.
Thank you, Mark. Thrilled to be here.
Before we get into the particulars of our conversation, the annual Gay Pride Parade was earlier this week, and I presume your organization had a contingent in it. I didn't see the whole parade myself, just parts of it, so I missed you if you passed by. But how was the experience?
Well, it was great. We marched under a theme of healthcare for everybody, and we have great new artwork supporting that important theme this year. And so we were out, as we usually are, marching for the cause of LGBTQ health and pride and liberation.
There you go. Well, that's a good starting point for our conversation then. So let's start with a bit of a general overview. How would you assess the state of LGBT New Yorkers, the health state of health for those folks?
Well, Mark, despite all of the advances that we had been seeing coming out of the federal government in terms of policy, and we're still seeing advances on the state level, happily, in LGBTQ issues and specifically health issues. The state of health for our communities locally still needs a lot of work. We still have a lot of folks who are living, as many other New Yorkers are, without adequate access to living wages and employment, and that certainly affects people's access to health care and health care services and housing. And so even when we're still living under the Affordable Care Act, at least in some form, we still have a lot of folks living without health care insurance these days. And for example, at Callan Lord, 26% of our patients are still uninsured. Before the Affordable Care Act, that number used to be around 40% for many years, and so that part is better. But even for folks who are accessing health insurance, especially our folks of transgender experience, getting access to appropriate care and even to the services specifically that people need is not a given, even with insurance. For example, the access to specific transgender health care related services, if people need surgery or access to hormone therapy, a lot of those services are still being denied by plans, despite that in New York State, health plans are mandated to actually cover those medically necessary services. And so we've been advocating to continue to see improvements about how those regulations are implemented and how people can and should be able to access services.
Yes, earlier this week, Governor Cuomo put out an executive order with relation to access to healthcare services for transgender people. What did the order say?
Well, we're still taking a look at it and trying to understand exactly how it's supporting those services. So as soon as we have digested it a bit, we will get back to you. I believe the intention of that really important executive order, though, is to both protect the provision of transgender health services as the federal government tries to erode access to those services, and to try to strengthen the original addition to regulations in New York State in 2015 that mandated the inclusion of transgender health benefits, both in the Medicaid program and for any insurance product being sold in the state. So I'm looking forward to digesting that new executive order and being able to report back on how I think it will help our communities.
Great. And I know some of people on your staff have been leading a multi-stakeholder effort on trying to get the state to address that stuff. So just wanted to ask about it, and we'll have you or one of your colleagues on in a future program to find out what's going on. You mentioned in the conversation certain things that in the field of public health are traditionally called social and economic determinants of health. Let's drill down a little more deeply on them. How are those playing? What are the major ones, and how are they playing out for LGBT New Yorkers?
Well, housing is definitely an issue in all of New York, affordable housing and supportive housing for those that need additional supports. And so we see a lot of our clients struggling with housing, whether folks are actually without housing at all, or they are achieving housing through really unstable situations, doubling up, couch surfing, sort of trading sex or other, you know, participating in other street economies to have shelter. And so housing remains a really important barrier to health for our communities. And it impacts us disproportionately, again, related to the lower rates of living wage employment that our communities have access to.
And what are some other things other than housing and wages that are of concern for LGBT New Yorkers when it comes to their health?
Sure. Well, in addition to both housing and access to care and access to competent quality care, I might add, living with the stress of the day-to-day reality of being LGBTQ is still hard for many parts of our populations. And so as we see any groups in New York and beyond living with the stress of discrimination or the fear of discrimination, living with hostility, living with the threat of violence, both interpersonal violence and sort of hate crime violence continues to be a real challenge and threat. And we continue to see transgender women of color being very disproportionately affected by these rates of violence in our communities. In addition to violence from others, suicide is a big problem in our communities. A tremendous percentage, over 70% of people of transgender experience will report having one or more suicide attempts in a lifetime.
Ooh, that's interesting and sobering to hear about. Your center started out as a community health center in Chelsea, which is a neighborhood with a lot of LGBT residents, but you've built out in recent years. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Sure. Well, our beginnings actually started, and this is a little known fact, the first iteration of Callan Lord Community Health Center was something called the St. Mark's Health Collective, which was started in St. Mark's Place.
I remember that.
Yes. And so we've been in the East Village or the West Village or Chelsea for, in some way, shape, or form for our 49-year history.
Wow.
And right now, yeah, we have two locations in Chelsea, a new location in the South Bronx, and we are building a new location in downtown Brooklyn, which we hope will be open in early 2020. And so we are trying to provide more services. The demand for our services is unfortunately much greater than the capacity of our services. And what's stopping us from building faster, building more, is real estate. Just like individuals, having access to the ability to grow here in New York is really dependent on one's ability to afford the rent.
Yes, indeed. For those who may not be familiar with your health center, I'll give you a moment to plug yourself a little bit. What kinds of services do you offer?
Well, we are a primary care facility, and we interpret primary care, or being able to access a medical provider, in an ongoing way for continuity care, both for preventive health as well as for the treatment of any chronic diseases or issues that may come up for a person. And we interpret primary care to mean medical care as well as mental health or behavioral health care, dental care, care coordination or case management, as it's often called. In other words, assistance with those social and economic determinants of health you mentioned earlier. And we also have on-site pharmacy services. In addition to all of the services we provide directly to folks, and we care for about 18,000 people now, and that number will increase to over 30,000 when our Brooklyn site opens, we also provide research and education. So we participate and, in fact, now lead a number of research initiatives to add to the body of knowledge about LGBTQ health, and we're very proud of that. We've undertaken the first long-term cohort study of people of transgender experience, which is very exciting. And on the education side, we train folks who are in clinical training programs. We also go out to other healthcare facilities and we'll do training there about LGBTQ health issues. And so we're trying to impact not just the folks that see us inside of our doors, but the healthcare sector writ large to be better at providing care to our communities.
Yeah, what's called in the language of healthcare, sort of a cultural competence, is the terminology. Tell us a little bit more about this research project into transgender health issues that you're conducting.
Sure, it's just getting started now, and it is federally funded, which we're very happy has happened in these times especially.
Mm.
And it allows us to follow, along with a number of other health centers and health entities throughout the country, I think there are six of us in total, to follow a cohort of several thousand people of transgender experience over time to see how their health outcomes look and what health issues might be of most concern in that population. And we don't have a lot of data here or anywhere in the world about transgender health, the health of transgender communities, and especially about long-term health outcomes.
When you get together with your fellow LGBT health center folks across the country, what's the conversation like? What are the topics that you all are focusing on or thinking about?
Yeah. Well, everybody's always talking about how to expand and how to afford that expansion and how to meet the incredible demand from our communities these days. And then, just like the rest of the healthcare sector, we're struggling with all kinds of things like data and electronic health records and how to sort of keep up with the changing regulations in healthcare, how to think about what federal policies that have been articulated or proposed under this administration, how those might impact our services and how we are able to keep going, even if there are some policy decisions that have negative impacts on our care and on our communities. And so it's everything from the mundane operations, if you will, that all healthcare entities have to deal with, to how to survive changing policies, to how to meet community demand, and how to have more data and really make sure that we're all providing quality care, and what quality care looks like and how we define what quality care looks like for our communities.
So let's talk a little bit about the policy issues that are of concern to organizations like yours. Let's start at the very local level here in New York City. What are some of the ways that you are talking to city officials about how health care and the health of LGBT New Yorkers can be improved?
Sure. Well, one important thing that happened in this fiscal year 19 city budget is that the city put forth more money than we thought it would, and this is really because of youth activists that made this happen. Mm. More money for beds, for shelter, for homeless LGBTQ youth, and that is hugely important and something that we certainly talk to and report on to city officials on a regular basis. We also are very excited to see the city moving toward having a non-binary gender marker on identification and using an X, which aligns with what some other countries and localities have used for that gender marker. And so hopefully that will one day be a globally standard access for documents.
Mm-hmm.
And so the city's really made some important strides in creating the kind of world we want to live in for LGBTQ health here. We certainly have a long way to go, and thinking about the continued effort to end the HIV epidemic, which mm-hmm. the city has been focusing on for the past several years, along with the state of New York, continuing to see more funding in that regard so that we really can do the work of ending new infections by 2020, which is very ambitious but very much needed. And so those are the kinds of things we tend to talk on the city level about.
And let's move up one level to New York State officials. We mentioned earlier the governor's executive order on mm-hmm. transgender access to health and health insurance. What other sorts of things are folks like you talking to state officials and legislators about?
Sure. Well, in coalition with many other organizations and individuals, we have been doing a lot of advocacy lately around moving toward a single payer in New York State, which we would, I think, greatly improve access to health care for our communities. And in addition to some of those broad issues, one of the things we've been wanting to see happen is a cultural and clinical competence curriculum that's mandated for all licensed healthcare professionals in New York State as part of that licensure or re-licensure process, as the case may be. So that's really important to us as well. We also work in coalition to advocate for comprehensive and LGBTQ-inclusive sexual education in schools, so start early to make sure that our younger generations are growing up with the best odds at achieving health as kids and adults. And those are some of our top issues at this point.
And finally, looking to the national government level, you mentioned some concerns you have about potential changes coming down from the federal government. What else are you talking to our local members of Congress about and our senators and so forth?
Yeah, well, all kinds of things. Certainly, over the past couple of years, we've seen some threats to some important pieces of legislation, which are foundational to Callan Lord, as well as some of our colleague health centers around the country, and that's the community health center funding. And happily, that funding was reappropriated in March for a two-year period. Historically, we've seen five-year reappropriations happen, and so we're keeping a close eye on that.
And that was a long fight, a good 6 months or so. Yeah,
it was. And it's really because of the advocacy network around the country that really sort of kept up the heat on that I think we saw that happen, and we didn't go onto a funding cliff there. Certainly, we've been sending in both patient and community and staff feedback about the rules around provider objections, providers being allowed to object to the provision of certain types of care or to certain individuals. Mm-hmm. We're very worried about how those that language, those regulations may affect our communities and providers' willingness to provide appropriate care, especially for folks of transgender experience. And so we've been working a lot on that, again, always in coalition, and continuing to think about the Affordable Care Act and the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, including Section 1557, which contains the anti-discrimination language in the Affordable Care Act, is very important to us as well.
Okay, so as we, in our last couple minutes or so, looking forward, both you as an institution, as a community health center, and sort of more broadly, what are you thinking about? What are you planning? You mentioned you've done the expansion in the Bronx, and you'll be going into Brooklyn. Anything else on the horizon?
Well, I hope so, but I have nothing to announce in that expansion regard yet. I do hope that we'll be able to continue to grow the research and education arms of our work, and that we'll be able to continue to get funding for those initiatives. And, you know, we continue to struggle with the unmet demand in our communities for our services and our inability to meet even the folks that are calling us on a day-to-day basis. So we're very worried about that constantly and really looking to our healthcare partners to continue to fill that gap as well.
And I dare say, as community health centers go, be they LGBT or whatever, you're not alone in that regard. There's a big demand for those centers, and many of us really value the role, important and key role, that community health centers play in our healthcare system. So hats off to you for that. We've been talking with Wendy Stark, Executive Director of Cal Lord Community Health Center, about LGBT health issues here in New York and the health of LGBT New Yorkers. Thanks so much for joining us on Health Action, Wendy.
Thank you so much, Mark. Really appreciate it.
And have a good rest of Pride Month, what's left the last few days here.
Thank you so much, too.
Bye.
All right.
And that'll do it for Health Action for this week. Thanks for joining us. Next week, Bob Letter and Catherine Davis will be here with the program. Thanks to Reggie Johnson for recording and editing the program. I'm Mark Hannay.
Have you heard about WBAI's discount program offering you savings on your prescribed medications? You can download your free discount card from WBAI.org. Every time you use it, you will save on your cost, and at the same time, you will be helping to support WBAI Radio. There is no extra cost, pledge, or subscription required. WBAI will receive $1.75 from NDC every time you use the card. Your collective participation in this program will help build a healthier WBAI. Check it out on WBAI.org and download your card today.
This is Comrade Karl Marx, and when I'm visiting the 21st century, I listen to Arts Express with host Prairie Miller. You have nothing to lose but your chains. You have a world to win. Listeners of the world, unite.
That's every Thursday at 2 p.m., Arts Express with host Prairie Miller, where art meets politics. And if you're down with the status quo, take the local.
You know, you're funny.
You mean, let me understand this, because maybe it's me, I'm a little up, maybe. But I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you? I make you laugh? I'm here to amuse you? What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
Ugh, you're just too funny, aren't you? Well, you want funny? Then go to WBAI's benefit comedy show, Too Raw for Radio, Monday, July 2nd at the Brooklyn Commons at 8 p.m., 388 Atlantic Avenue. $13 gets you laughs and a $3 credit towards a drink at the Commons Cafe. Too Raw for Radio. Find us on Facebook. Ha ha.
That's Too Raw for Radio, comedy to support WBAI on Monday, July 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in the Borough Hill section of Brooklyn. Red Hills is an engaging two-person play that follows an American and a Rwandan who, as teens during the 1994 genocide in Rwanda, shared a chance encounter that changed them forever. Red Hills, directed by Katie Pearl, features Patrick J. Sanjovu and Christopher McLinton, with live music by Farai Malinanga and Safiso Mabina. Performances run through July 1st and take place at 101 Greenwich Street near Rector in Manhattan. For more info, go to unguardarts.org. That's unguardarts.org.
Hello, listeners. I'm WBI's General Manager, Berto Reimers. I'm happy to announce that we have successfully moved out of the Empire State Building and are now transmitting from 4 Times Square. This is a major accomplishment and a turning point in our history, with a savings to WBI of $50,000 per month. With your help, we have preserved this precious media, but the task has just begun. We are now engaged in a campaign to liquidate the loan that allowed us to move forward. I encourage you to become a BAI buddy, a sustaining member to help WBI bring in a steady, predictable income. We want to reduce and eventually eliminate on-air fund drives. Please go to WBAI.org and become a member, and stay tuned for exciting new programming launching on WBAI in the very near future. Thank you.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, after a review from Dan Persons and a promo or two, I will do The World Well Lost by Theodore Sturgeon. Thank you.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Okay, so we're going to take a step back here, because I still haven't seen Incredibles 2. I tried. I was about 30 minutes into it when something happened that you wouldn't particularly be interested in, and I got called away. But we're going to take a look at a couple of TV shows that I finally caught up with, and that both raise a question about serialized storytelling. There's a lot of good that happened when TV series started building story arcs that would span across episodes or an entire season or even multiple seasons. It got TV shows out of their zero-sum curse where everything had to be reset at the end of each episode because there was no certainty that episodes would air in the order they were filmed. Girlfriends introduced at the start of the hour didn't have to die off by the end. Characters could undergo epiphanies, their personalities could change and grow, that giant lollipop that was introduced in episode 1 could shrink correctly all the way through episode 13, stuff like that. The problem with grand arcs is that it takes a certain amount of skill to tell a story over the span of 13 or so episodes. One doesn't necessarily have to be a great writer, but one does need to know what kind of tale is worthy of being portioned out over 590-plus minutes. Quite often, what the creators decide is going to be the framework around which to build their first season turns out to be not as solid a structure as they would hope. Because first seasons are very often exercises in discovery for a show's creators, the grand arc turns out to be not much more than extended table setting, essentially a season-long prequel to the story they really want to tell. If you want to think of a fictional story as the hero's journey, very often first seasons are about the hero or heroine packing his/her bags and getting out the front door. The time isn't worth the effort. That was an issue with Star Trek Discovery. I had to wait a while to watch the back half of season 1 until another offer for a free month of CBS All Access rolled around, because nothing in the front half motivated me to pay $6 for a subscription. I have to say that the show roused itself significantly after the pit that was its pilot, which spanned over the first 2 episodes. And despite assurances from a number of people, the second episode, which wrapped up the story, wasn't any better than the first. Just because you put a period on a sentence doesn't make it poetry. I should also note here that my personal bete noire on the production staff, executive producer Akiva Goldsman, wrote and directed the third ep, which was actually one of the better episodes of the series. So mea culpa there. And the central idea of the series, that for the first time in Star Trek history, our main protagonist is not a captain or admiral or some such, but a lower-level officer, Michael Burnham, nicely played by Sonequa Martin-Green, is a clever way to break the mold, and that the dark, troubling universe we experience here actually represents Burnham's journey to understanding the reason for the hope and idealism of the Federation would be an interesting story to tell over an episode, or at best a handful of episodes. For it to take 15 episodes with an overextended, multi-ep detour into the Mirror Universe, that obverse of Federation idealism that has served previously as a kind of palate cleanser, good for an episode-long dip so we get the contrast but not much more, with some ill-thought-out character deaths and a couple of character reveals, one of which seems to have been born out of a lead player deciding to take an early exit from the series, the other of which involves a character having undergone some sort of surgical and mind transfer procedure that I still don't understand, despite it being explained at least a half dozen times, for it to take that many episodes to get us to where the next season will potentially see a return to Roddenberry-esque idealism, and possibly the first appearance of this series' version of Spock, given the overall uneven quality of the series so far, I'm inclined to wait for another free month before checking out how things work out. Alex Kurtzman is taking over as showrunner for season 2. He has considerable background in genre, some slips, but an equal number of successes, so I'm crossing my fingers. There was a similar seasonal arc issue with Netflix's reboot of Lost in Space. It's essentially taken an entire season to get the spacefaring Robinson family truly lost in space. Leading up to that point meant that they were marooned on a very weird planet with frozen tundras, apparently a half day's walk from tropical rainforests, along with other survivors of the wrecking of a giant space transport. The Jupiter spaceships here are more landing vessels / high-tech homesteads, rather than being completely stranded on their own from the get-go. That's not a bad break from the original concept, or the horrendous feature film version that was also overseen by, wait for it, Akiva Goldsman. My antipathy towards him is not completely unmotivated. In fact, most of the breaks and elaborations engineered by creators Matt Sazema and Burke Sharpless are pretty well considered. Granted, they had a low bar to clear in coming up with something better than what Irwin Allen did in the 1960s. Even at age 11, I watched the show thinking, man, this is dumb. But making Maureen an engineer rather than just a steadfast wife, working some marital strife between her and her husband John, he's led astray by career, not a mistress. This is still a family show. Making the robot initially an imposing alien antagonist before young Will Robinson pulls a symbolic thorn from his figurative paw, both help to shake the rust off the concept if you were acquainted with the original series, and give it enough substance to intrigue those who were coming to it fresh. This still is not top-tier storytelling, though. The science is dodgy, again the world they land on has a disturbingly Jekyll and Hyde personality that a late plot complication meant to explain the upheaval doesn't really explicate. Characterizations are uneven, especially that of Dr. Smith, who here is portrayed by Parker Posey, and whom the producers struggle to make empathetic while also maintaining her dark, self-serving nature. They're trying for enigmatic, more often it's just confusing. And yet, even though it takes an entire season to get the Robinsons to where it took the original series, 2 or 3 episodes, I didn't much mind the trip. No, I actually enjoyed picking up on each episode. This is not The Expanse, but it was a more invigorating SF adventure than the dark and frequently dour Star Trek Discovery. I'm hopeful that Discovery will find its footing in the next season. Keep in mind that the first 2 seasons of Star Trek The Next Generation mostly sucked, but I'll return to Lost in Space pretty happily. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons, # ITMFA.
And I asked Dan what that # stands for exactly, and it's unprintable. And therefore, also, unless I, you know, go out and get a disclaimer and all kinds of stuff like that, unbroadcastable. Let's see. So where are the headphone volumes over there? Ah, there we are. Now I can actually hear myself. Very good. So, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. I am Jim Freund. We have a focused agenda for the morning, but a couple of announcements. Number one is this would be a good show that if you want to watch, this would be a good one because it's basically just me and it's doing a reading. So hopefully that adds a little dimension to it. So if you want to watch, what you do is you go to Facebook. And you go to look for Facebook Live, and you can actually go to my timeline. Let me see. I think if I go here, I'm actually logged in. And yep. And you know what? I'm going to share it to a couple of places so that you can also watch it in the Hour of the Wolf group. Isn't that an interesting, since this radio show's Hour of the Wolf, there we are. Okay, no, I'm not going to share it to Sin on Celluloid, which is a very